Hello and welcome to another edition of the LinuxInstall.net podcast. This is episode number 117, recorded on Tuesday, July 8th, 2014. It's all about the Chumpy. In this episode, Walt reminds us that the Chumpy still exists, and that it's back to life. Brian talks about his experiences with Arch, and we don't know what to do. But anyways, we also talked about the init. 6 versus shutdown-r versus reboot command debate. But before we go on to the podcast, don't forget to follow us at Linux Install on Twitter. Find our community at plus.linuxinstall.net on Google Plus. And of course, you can always send us feedback at podcasts@linuxinstall.net. But without any further ado, let's get on with the show. Hello and welcome to another edition of the LinuxInstall.net podcast. I'm your host, Brian Wagner. With me, almost as always, I guess I missed one recently and Walt missed one recently. And Joe's the only one who hasn't missed one recently. Mr. Joseph Luzzi.
Good evening, gentlemen.
And also with us tonight is Mr. Walt Chivik.
Hello. Being burnt by the big glowing sky orb.
Enjoy it now, because you know in a few months it's not going to be there, and we're all going to be complaining about it.
Yeah. But we still have a few months where it's really hot and really nasty, although that hasn't really happened to us much this year, so I can't really complain.
And we've had a couple of hot days, but I think I was talking to Kim earlier, and I was just saying that the storms we've had haven't been consistent, but the ones that have come through have definitely done some damage around the area.
Yeah, we've been getting slammed.
Yeah.
And even the hot days weren't hot. They were just humid, in my opinion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Welcome to life in northeastern Ohio.
Yes. Yes, it is. So what have you been up to lately, Joe?
Working on the podcast, getting a bunch of things going for that one. I've been wanting to download CentOS 7. I started to download it earlier, but then I stopped it because when you called, I was in the middle of patching, and it wasn't going to finish in time because I had just started it. So I didn't realize I had started it so late. I didn't realize what time we were starting this. So I see. I thought we were moving it up an hour from the emails that I received from the calendar earlier. I got a little confused because of everything that came through. So, hey,
all right, we're cool. I'm here. Here's my complaint about that. That is a Gmail issue. Gmail, for some reason, and time zone switching don't go well together. And for some reason, Gmail wasn't recognizing that I was no longer in Dallas and I was back in Ohio. So I opened my calendar today and went, wait, why does that say 6:30? That shouldn't say 6:30. Let me change that. And that's when all the fun began. Then I realized after I changed it that it really was right. My Gmail calendar was off by an hour. Which you would think, since I switched it on my phone and my computer, that it would have figured out that the time zone that I was in, but it didn't. I don't know why. It doesn't make any sense. So anyways, so I apologize for that.
That's okay. No problem. I kind of figured it was still going to be around the same time, but I was just sitting around playing a game anyway. Yes.
So have you done anything with Linux other than work? I mean,
yeah. Working with it on a daily basis. That's about enough nowadays, trust me.
Okay. So, Walt, how about you? What you been up to?
Well, I would like to announce, so many days later, the official return of the Chumpy.
Woo! I read about that.
Hells yeah. Dude, this is let me put this up here. I'll wait. It's an amazing feat, in my opinion. I don't know how much you guys know about what the device is or the history of the company or any of that stuff.
I think we actually talked about it way long ago on a much, much earlier podcast, Brian. Yes. I think when it first came out, we talked about it quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure we did.
Yeah.
That was so long ago. Bring everybody up to speed.
Yeah.
Because I don't know what's all changed.
The company Chumpy came out with, I believe it was supposed to be basically like a developer's platform device that other companies were supposed to take and develop apps or whatever it was, you know, for the said device. They sold a beanbag-like one with a screen. Later on, they went to the Chumpy 1 and then the Chumpy 8, which were hard-shelled. And Sony's is it the Dash, I think, licensed that technology and came out with a device. And then the one that I have, the Best Buy Insignia series, came out and licensed a device. And there was one or two other, I don't know if they were in the United States, they might have been European devices that actually came out. But the long and short of it is it's a little Linux box with a 320 by 240 screen, if you got the 3-inch one, and 800 by 600 for the bigger ones, that logs into the Chumbi server, downloads its operating system, and then plays back a series of Flash-based widgets that do everything from displaying Twitter feeds or getting the weather or interactive mail. And in my opinion, it was one of those a good idea before its time devices. You know, me being buying a lot of gadgets, I see that quite often where a higher price tag killed something, and then so many years later when something becomes commonplace, in our case now, like phones and tablets that are, you know, $100, do everything that this device did years ago. So
now, how much were they when they originally were out? Do you happen to remember? Because I don't off the top of my head.
I want to say $100 for the 3-inch, and it might have been $200 or even more for the 8. They were pretty expensive. And considering it was basically just a fancy clock picture frame kind of device, it really was overpriced. But the problem was is that Chumbi didn't plan on selling hardware. They just wanted to license the design and then let bigger companies absorb the cost and make their own devices. All the software, though, was free. So you got like, I don't know, a couple thousand apps that you can run as long as you bought one of these things. So I thought the idea was really cool. And because it was a little Linux box, there's a USB plug in the back of it. You can plug in a USB key, put in a text file, a little script, and then you got root access. So you can load your own. Like I had one that was running a web server, and you can do SSH, and you know, you can do all the stupid little Linux things. So I thought it was going to be an awesome little hacker toy. And there was a pretty decent community around it. So a little over a year ago or so, Chumbi, unfortunately, didn't license enough of these things that they needed to do, and the company went out of business. Because the device has to log into their server to download its OS and run the widgets, all of a sudden you had 40-some thousands of these things that were basically paperweights. So there's a guy, his online handle, Dwayne, formed a company called Blue Octi, and he bought the licensing and copyright and all that other fun stuff from Chumbi and set up a temporary server that would display a single widget. It was a Lacars-based clock with a little calendar in the corner. And it was the coolest thing in the world. And I was very pleased that I was actually able to use the device. Now, the device, once you got the OS, though, it did have some built-in alarm clock features, some music playback features, some local media playback like MP3 and whatnot. So because it at least got a ping that a server existed, you could still use some of the local features. But I loved that clock, so I kept mine running just on my desk over here to have a cool Star Trek clock. So a week ago, I come downstairs and I look, and my Star Trek clock's gone, and I got this new Blue Octi clock looking at me. And I'm like, what the heck is this? So I go to the website, and come to find out, over the last year, Dwayne rewrote the entire back-end server.
Oh, holy crap.
Because he bought all of the licensing, he had the original user registration database with all the device registrations, set up a new server, set up the new backend, reprogrammed some of the client stuff, and then all of a sudden, a year or some later, all these things just quote-unquote woke back up, and they're all fully functional with 1,000-some apps again. Because not just one guy, but basically one guy's vision and a few people helping him, they were able to make that happen. So,
see, I never realized that there were 1,000 apps for it. I remember when Brian and I first talked about it, we knew that there were some. I never realized there was that extensive of a library available for it.
Yeah, there's actually many, many more. There's only 1,000 of the original library that still work. Because a lot of them, like, give you an example, like the Twitter, over the last year, how many times did Twitter change their API? So that original app doesn't even log into their servers anymore. So, you know, that's one that the original developer now has to go back and modify if they want to use it. But there's a lot of third-party independent apps, you know, like clocks and things like that, or local servers or media players or photo flippers or whatever that weren't dependent upon anything else, that still worked just fine. The only get you now is this individual does not have any capital to run the service for free. So it's a $3 a month subscription in order to actually get any widget other than the default clock and calendar, which I think isn't that big of a deal. I mean, we're looking at what, 36 bucks a year.
Is he doing 36 bucks a year?
Right now you have to pay $3 a month, which is kind of ridiculous.
See, because, okay, I'm a huge Pandora fan. Pandora had allowed you to do annual plans, which were a slight discount. My sister would do that for me for Christmas. That was my Christmas present for the last couple of years. And all of a sudden this year, they've announced that that will no longer exist. You will have to buy a monthly. You have to pay monthly, which makes no sense to me.
Right. And the third party, billing company or whatever that he's working with, I think more or less he wanted to get it out to market as quick as possible. These guys are like, yeah, we can do it, but this is how you have to do it. And that's just kind of how it is right now. There's been a lot of feedback of people that want to pay yearly, you know, or instead of the monthly subscription. Sorry, I got a cat sleeping on me and my leg went and fell asleep. So all that stuff's in the works. But like a lot of people were saying, like even their credit card company, when you only do a $3 charge, especially if it's something reoccurring, you know, it gets flagged for, you know, improper, invalid use or, you know, whatever. So, I want to subscribe because I want my Star Trek clock back, but, B, it's just, there's, you know, and I don't want to go off on a huge tangent on this, but there's I want to say it was either 43,000 or 34,000 of these things that logged in the day that server went back live. So there's a lot of them out there, and there's about four or five guys in the forum complaining that now they got to pay for this service. And I don't think they understand how the device works, how it logs in, how this dude kept their device working at least at a minimal functionality for a year out of his own pocket, and that if none of this happened, they would have had a paperweight over a year ago.
But they don't have to pay it. I mean, that's the way I would look at it. If you want to complain, don't pay it.
But the complaint was, oh, I had this cool Star Trek clock for a year and it was free, so now why do I have to pay $3 a month to get that clock again? Because it's an official widget that he developed, so he was that was the why he did it. But this new widget now is that kind of it's got a little bit of advertising on it, so that you know that you can actually subscribe, which I think is fine. But the negativity of just like people who get frustrated.
It's the internet, Walt. It's the internet.
I know, and that's why I don't read forums.
There you go. You can still buy the Chumby though. I just looked that up.
Yeah, I think he was. I thought one of the stories I heard said he was. Who'd you say, Dwayne? I don't remember his last name. I think he was developing additional hardware to sell, also, or he had somebody helping him develop that hardware. I don't know because he owned all the licensing, so he could license it to whoever he wants.
He owned all of the old inventory.
Oh, he'll okay.
So that's what he would sell to try to subsidize over the last year. They made T-shirts and buttons and stickers, but he actually had all the old inventory too. So as he refurbished them, they would go up on the website to be resold.
Yeah, because he has the Chumby 8 red and black for $100. Then he has a ton of used ones in various colors, which are $60. So it's $100 for the 8 and then $60 for the small, cushy ones.
Yeah, no, and
did you say the 8 was an 8-inch screen?
Hold on. Yes.
Sorry.
And I know when I got mine, I got them when they were on clearance for $50. And I think $50 for the 3-inch, so if he's at the 60 price point, that's pretty close, is a pretty good deal. The 8, you got a better screen for a web browser, because at least it's 800 by 600. So certain uses or features like... there's an app where you can have server stats displayed. You basically run a little PHP script on your server. It sends the information to the Chumby, and you can have lights light up when certain things are online or offline or running or whatnot. So on my little 3-inch screen, I can maybe have 4 or 5 lines of stats, and that's really about it. On that bigger 8-inch, I can actually have a pretty nice, you know, panel. So there's some reasons to have it, but most of the apps are developed for the 320 by 240 screen. So on the 8-inch at 800 by 600, they're just blown up. And in my opinion, they look kind of crappy. So depending upon what your need is, I have a hard time arguing the 8. You know, I think the three is a pretty nice device, though.
Hmm. Well, very cool.
So, yeah, so a cool little Linux box brought back to life by the amazing work of folks who just wanted to do it on their own.
See, and I thought the Chumby was a totally different device before this last week when he turned this back on.
Really? What did you think it was? Because since we had discussed this before, Brian.
I didn't think it was this. I thought there was, okay, so there was like a rabbit or something that you could send tweets to and it would talk and it would do stuff, and I thought that was the Chumby.
No.
That was this.
I know what you're talking about. I remember that too, but no, that's not.
Yeah. And so I'm looking at this device and going, you know, I would have been a sucker for these just like Walt, and I don't understand why I don't own one. But I don't.
Yeah.
I probably should, but I don't. Hopefully when I, you know, get done paying off some bills, I actually have money left over to buy one of these.
Yeah, my hope is the widgets, because you have to develop them in Flash, and it's an older version now that hasn't been upgraded. You're kind of limited on a lot of stuff. So I'm hoping that now that a interest of the device has been proven by the number of people who have subscribed, and if the subscriptions continue, you know, Dwayne's already said that they'll be in the black after so many months, even the last year's worth of stuff that he fronted on his own, that they redesign the OS to maybe do HTML5 or something a little bit more, you know, open and common, so that more people can do stuff easily with it.
Now, since it is an older version of Flash, what type of security vulnerabilities are there possibly inherent in this device?
To the best of my knowledge, it's so old there aren't any. It's like, okay. It's safe because of and being so antique and twigged, something I can't pronounce.
Antiquated.
Antiquated. There you go.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. That's extremely funny, because I remember when Brian and I talked about it, I know it had to be in one of the early episodes of our podcast here. I'm guessing well within the first year. Because how old is it, Walt? When did it first come out?
Oh, man.
How many years ago?
It's been a while. I mean, I know I've had mine for a couple of years now. Let me see if I can look real quick.
Wikipedia to the rescue!
Yep.
Yeah, it's pretty much exactly where I just went.
Premiered on August 25th, 2006.
There you go.
Wow, that would have been... No, that would have been before we did the podcast, Joe.
Yeah, that would have been before we did the podcast, but I remember when I could have swore we talked about this.
I know we talked about it at some point.
Yeah, see, November of 2009 is when the Chumby 1 came out. Those were the first ones that weren't those beanbag-type devices, and that's when I got
that would have been when we would have talked about it, because that would have been, we started in July of 2009.
Yeah,
yep.
That probably sounds about right.
Yeah.
Like I said, it was probably in the first year.
Yep.
Scary that it's been that long. Insane.
Scary that you still remember it.
I just remember stupid things.
Cool. So everybody needs to go buy a Chumby and then help support the dude who's done all this stuff to make it actually work. That's really cool.
Heck yeah.
And hopefully at some point he'll... It's $3 a month. It's really not that much. The problem is I keep saying that about everything. So I have all these, like, you know, it's only a couple dollars a month, or it's $5 a month. Then all of a sudden it's like, you know, $3 here, $5 there, $10 there. Gosh, you got some
hundred or so. Hundred or so dollars later coming out of your checking account each month.
Yeah.
For stuff that's like, going, well.
You think about it, I mean, for $3 a month, that's like, so you don't get a coffee one day. But you have to be diligent enough not to get a coffee one day. Otherwise, that doesn't really work.
Yes, that is true. So have you been up to anything else?
Or just no, that's it. I've just been geeking out on that a little bit.
Cool. All right, well, I've been playing with Arch Linux.
Woohoo!
Yay! And while at times I feel like I'm starting over with Linux, it's not that bad, but only because there aren't the pretty GUIs and simple stuff to do. So I have to actually remember how to do things like configure interfaces and then scream and shout about systemd and why did they have to change everything that I used to know how to do.
Yeah, that's...
work now, because now I have to read stuff, and it's really... I don't know why they made networking so complicated with systemd, but it is really complex.
So is networking easier on the Windows side?
No. No, and it's not, because I can troubleshoot Linux quicker than I can ever troubleshoot anything on Windows. And things like DHCP work more consistently, even with that. Like, if I had just left the box alone and just stayed with DHCP, the systemd stuff worked. Like, it was pre-configured for DHCP, and it worked fine. On Windows, DHCP works, but if somebody hasn't properly configured IPv6 and the AD DNS server or DHCP server knows about IPv6 but isn't configured for IPv6, you'll have all kinds of weird issues. Like, network pages don't come up that should. DNS resolution doesn't work properly. And then all you go in is turn off IPv6, reboot your machine, and everything's fine.
Hells yeah. But
because IPv6 was checked, and because somebody didn't know what they were doing on the DHCP side on the IPv6 on the Windows server, it can cause all kinds of problems. So no, this is easier, because even if IPv6 is there, it might come up, but it'll go to whatever works. It doesn't prefer, Windows prefers IPv6 if it's available, which is kind of a bad stance at this point, because I don't know too many companies that are actually properly or even taking the time to think about configuring IPv6.
I was going to say, have you seen anybody actually? I mean, I haven't. Different people that I've talked to, I mean, I really haven't seen or read too much of people actually even working with it yet.
Most network meetings I've been in, when new hardware purchase or technology, upgrades are talked about, IPv6 is always one of the first things where they have to make sure it's in it, but nobody's there.
Yeah, exactly. They want it there just in case we have to turn it on one day. Right. So we just want to make sure it's right. We're ready. So we can't say we weren't prepared.
That's right.
It's a little check mark, yeah. Basically, in somebody's list. Okay, that's there. Check.
The only people that I have not seen any companies do it yet, only because, referred to Walt's comment about hardware, software solutions, there are still too many legacy solutions that do not support it. Or really old printers, like, the printer works fine. The old HP DeskJet, LaserJets. Mm-hmm. The older ones that still, you can still get cartridges for, so nobody's bothered to get rid of them. Even though the drivers don't really work as well on Windows 7 and 8. But, you should upgrade your printers. That's for a friend of mine who works for the government here in the great state of Ohio, who hasn't bothered to upgrade their printer yet. But, yeah, I haven't seen anybody at a corporate side do it. I have friends that have done it. I have watched and listened to people talk about doing it. But, yeah, no, I don't know anybody doing it. Matter of fact, I even participated. I had it set up at one point before I got married, that long ago. Like, we're talking, I've been married for 10 years. So 2004, 2003 was the last time I set it up, and it kind of worked. But I don't see a reason to do it at this point still, even though we're out of addresses.
Which kills me, because we've been out of addresses for how many years now?
Well, somebody put out a sheet of infographic basically showing where the IP addresses are being used, or like who owns the IP addresses. And companies like Apple, IBM, and HP own literally billions of addresses, and they're not using anywhere near that many. So it doesn't make a lot of sense as to why they still are holding on to them. So if they wanted to start selling them, I don't know if they're waiting for some black market to show up for for IPv4 addresses, because we're out of them in the U.S., supposedly. I don't know. These guys would all be sitting on caches of IPv4 addresses that are pretty huge. But they all seem to want everybody to go to IPv6, too. So who knows? Maybe they're just going to hoard them and do all that stuff. But anyways, so I've been playing with Arch. Arch is... it's cool. Just like every other Linux, I like them all. They're all good. Been having fun. I like Arch for servers right now, but I don't know if I'm going to continue that way. Mostly because Arch's default stance is the bare minimum, and you have to install everything that you want. And I happen to know what I want. Most people probably don't. But it also means it takes a little while, especially when I'm doing this on my Raspberry Pi and have to wait for it to... Actually, the downloading hasn't been the problem. It's been whatever Arch has to do once it's trying to install certain pieces of software, and I don't know what that was, but it took like 2 hours to install about 70 patches the other day. Which was pretty rough. Really? And I don't think that was Arch at all. I think that was completely the Raspberry Pi because it was running at about 3 or 4 load and only about 75% CPU utilization. But
that's what I was going to say, man, because I've been running stuff on ARM that's way slower than I shouldn't say way slower, but equivalent to the Pi or slower. Uh-huh. And it doesn't take that long to do some of that stuff. So.
Yeah, it was working. Like, it was nice progressions of numbers and, you know, nice feedback, and it let me know that it was doing something, so it didn't just go off and sit there with a black screen for 2 hours. It, you know, showed me progress. Hmm. But yeah, the downloads didn't take that long. That was like maybe 15 minutes, and then it took forever to do the actual installs.
You know, the I/O could be the problem, depending upon what SD you're using. Because I noticed, like, depending, I don't know what the classes are, but, you know, like, if I got, like, a class 2 and a class 10, you know, there's pretty big write speed differences, and on some of those little hacker devices, that makes a big difference. I mean, you know, we know just from going from spinning platter to SSD how big a difference that is on the same hardware, so, you know, you got a lot of disk I/O when you're doing patches and it updates.
And I completely think that's what it was. Is it's trying to write a bunch of stuff to a bunch of different places, and it just was getting stuck in the I/O pipe. And I think it was completely the Raspberry Pi's fault. I don't think it was Arch. Yeah. Because I don't see any reason for it. That would be Arch's problem.
So what are you doing on either with the Pi or with Arch that you weren't going to run the Debian install or something else?
I wanted to try Arch, so that was why I was running it. And I have had a ClearOS machine, which is basically a variant of CentOS, that came into my awareness when the CentOS guys were going kind of wonky, and it wasn't looking like they were like that project was going to survive because the leader of the project just disappeared for 6 months or 9 months or something like that. So I had switched over to using ClearOS because at the time I wanted to get rid of the Ubuntu machines that I was playing with and have some non-Ubuntu machines just so that I kept reminding myself what was different about them. So I wouldn't lose any of that. And maybe the newer versions of ClearOS are better. There were a lot of little issues with the ClearOS system itself. The OS, if I SSH into it was fine, but their GUI wasn't as polished as I was led to believe when I listened to the interview. So I had been doing everything manually, and I wanted a separate machine, not on my VMware machine, that actually did DNS and DHCP. So I'm going to use the Pi for that. So I figure super low power, DHCP, DNS really don't consume that much resources, so it should be able to handle it just fine. I may put some other stuff on there later. I don't know. I know better than to try to put I/O on there. There's been plenty of articles out there written about the I/O on the Pi is just too slow. Don't try to use it as a file server because you'll get killed on performance. So
it's all right for a backup machine, you know, where you don't have to like do real time. It could just run overnight and you don't really care about the speed. But
yeah,
I agree, no more than that.
But the first time I attempted this, I hadn't expanded the disk on the to use the full 16 gigs that I have on that SD card. And I filled the disk up really quickly.
Yep.
So I may go back and rerun that stuff. I was trying to run the Gunnery Django software and see if I could get a system up for my wife to use, like we were talking about a couple episodes when it was just you and I, well, a few episodes back. But, yeah, I don't know. Like I said, Pac-Man isn't that bad. It seems to do a really good job of resolution, of dependency resolution.
I think it's great.
It's, yeah. Right now, I'd have a hard time picking between Yum, Zipper on the RPM-based systems. I still love apt. And Pac-Man is right there with them. So much less concerned than I was before I started, because it had been a long time since I'd used Arch. It wasn't nearly as polished as it is now, but they've done a good job and it's come a long way. So it's really good.
Yeah, I think you're right on that. Over the last couple of years, I'd say 2 years, they've really cleaned it up to the point where, again, it's not a new user experience OS, but you know, once you get familiar, especially like you said, since unless you install a GUI, it's all command line. If you want though, it's all there to install. You just got to set it up. You know, but yeah, it's everything's pretty polished. I don't run into things that break very often anymore. To be honest, when it went the big switch to systemd was the only thing I've ever had issue with. And that was more just because so many things changed and there were so many, you know, old file paths that had to be updated and, you know, this and that. That's really the only issue I've ever had with it, and I've been running it for years.
Well, now that everybody has decided on systemd, at least all the major providers, all the major Linux distros have decided on systemd, so I can't imagine somebody not going with systemd.
Yeah.
At this point, because there's just overwhelming drive to go in one direction and to get them all using the same init system. That being said, I have not had a great experience with systemd to this point, and I think it's more that I just need to work with it more. But
it was so really easy to do stuff before, I thought. I mean, that was one of the things I loved about Arch, and I didn't realize, I didn't have the knowledge to know that the init system was why it was so much easier. I just thought, oh, that's how they do it instead of the way everybody else does it. You know, and then when they switched like everybody else, I was like, oh, that sucks.
Yeah, I have to go like do some stuff, and I probably should write a tutorial or two about how to migrate yourself over, since I am so used to the init system, the old init system. I mean, it's just, I understand that it's better and it's faster and it's, you know, more bells and whistles. Yeah. But there's something to be said for the simplicity.
Yes.
Just like, you know, I mean, I know I can do ACLs in Linux, but once I start doing them, I start feeling like I'm working on a Windows system where I'm not quite sure where the security is being set on the file system. And is that an NTFS setting because I'm doing a share, or is it an... I mean, is it an NTFS setting because it's just an OS level, or is it a share setting, and they can conflict, and if you, yeah, it's really complex. And ACLs get the same way.
I mean, yeah.
But anyways, so that's what I've been doing. I'm trying to get that set up. And that's most cool. of the reason why I'm not done now is because I went through and actually looked at my configurations for DHCP and DNS, which I probably haven't touched in, a really long time, other than to add and remove stuff. I haven't really cleaned anything up. Probably since I put that ClearOS box up and found a whole bunch of machines I haven't had in years and went, well, I should just delete these from DNS. And wow, I got huge blocks of IP addresses I'm not using, because I thought I was running out of IP addresses. No, I'm not really. Just, you know, all that good stuff. So I spent a couple hours last night watching Orange is the New Black and editing text files. To nice. Remove them and put them in order.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, it wasn't. But it's done now, so I don't have to do it. And I'm using Git to store them all now. And I'm going to use Git to pull them so that I can push up, and then I'm going to write some hooks to pull them down when I upload them. So when the system sees a change, it'll automatically pull it down and update it, so I don't have to do it. Hmm. Or worry about DNS syncing, which is or can be extremely insecure. So... All right, so I don't know if we're going to talk about both of these, but I had this one thing. So I was looking around today. I got an email from LinkedIn, and it said, hey, go look at this story, which I will link to there. And it was asking people how they restart their systems from the command line. And I was shocked at how many people still do init space 6 or do even... the more crazy but really more proper sync, either sync halt init 6 or sync init 6. And I believe that the right way is to do one of two things, either to do a reboot command, which catches and uses the proper init system for that, or proper startup system, whether that's systemd or init or whatever the other one is.
Well, from my understanding, I think one of the big things with reboot is it's probably the more polite thing to do on a server, especially if you work in an environment where you have multiple admins, because it will alert the other admins the system's going down.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's so that.
That's the polite thing to do with a reboot.
Right. And reboot in a lot of systems is actually just calling a shutdown -r space now. So it doesn't say, yeah, those two commands are pretty much equal. There isn't really much of a difference. It also makes sure that it shuts things down in a proper ordered fashion, whereas init 6 just changes to that run level and be damned to anything that happened to be running. So if your database server was running, you just killed it, and it may or may not have shut down properly. It depends on how init was set up to handle it. Whereas, like Joe said, reboot or shutdown -r will... do a much cleaner and more polite. That is a great way to put it, Joe.
Well, now the shutdown -r, I don't think alerts people it's shutting down, does it? I thought just the reboot did.
Yeah, it does. No,
it does. Okay.
Yeah, because in some systems, reboot is just a alias to shutdown -r.
I think most of it is because reboot doesn't exist in them all, and that's why I've always done the shutdown -r.
But either way, I just thought it was really funny. I just had to comment on it.
Well, I haven't even heard about changing the init run level since like the early 90s.
Yeah.
So that's funny that
I would say
a consideration or people would maybe even know to do that.
Close to 50% of the people said init 6. A whole bunch of people said, no, you should be. And there's like some people very adamant, but you should be either using shutdown-r or reboot.
I think I always got into the habit of doing the shutdown-r now. And I don't know why, but it was something I got when I first started getting into Linux, you know, when I was working with you, Brian. It was just kind of something I got in the habit of doing over just even a reboot.
Probably because when you started working with me, reboot was sketchy as to whether it was going to be there, depending on which system you logged into.
Yeah, and I think you're probably right.
And so it just was like, shutdown-r. And then if you went to Ubuntu, you know, most of the tutorials said shutdown-r too.
Yeah, and I think it's just something I got in the habit of doing. Because it's funny, we were actually talking about some of this stuff at work the other day. You know, which one was the proper one to do?
What did you guys decide?
I did the shutdown-r. But then Steve was the one who actually started talking about reboot saying the polite way. And I thought he said shutdown-r didn't actually alert the people that it was going down.
And it may be that there's an inconsistency in the way they're executing it on all the different systems.
Yeah, right.
Because, yeah.
My Debian box does, I can tell you that.
Yeah, but it's really funny that we're talking about this because I swear we were just talking about this literally a couple of days ago.
That's funny.
Yeah, I still have one machine that I have to use Halt for. It's, again, one of those ARM hack devices. And I think it has to run an old 2.4 kernel because of some compatibility layer, something. And for whatever reason, I actually have to do the Halt on it in order to make it work. But with that one exception out of dozens others, yeah, I've always done the shutdown -r.
Yeah, over the years, I don't know if I've ever done it in init 6 on a server.
I haven't done one in a
while. I can't think of a time of ever doing one, unless if I just did it at home, just when I was learning Linux, just to play around with it, just to see what it did.
Right. That's what I was going to say. I remember early 90s when I was still learning how to do everything, you know, transitioning a little bit off of mainframe to, you know, PC-based Linux, and reading about that and probably doing it a couple of times. But
right. But I mean, considering like what you were saying, Brian, that it doesn't really shut down everything properly. It just kind of takes the rug out from under everything. I think that's the reason why I've always just been in the habit of either the reboot or shutdown-r now. And like I said, more of the shutdown-r now.
Yeah.
So, okay, well, here's a question then. And this is something that I've run into. The -r, obviously, is the reboot flag.
Right.
So what do you do to actually shut down the machine?
-h, halt. Isn't that it, Brian?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, shutdown-h is a halt.
What a correct to do for a rug. Go ahead.
I say I've run into a couple systems that wouldn't work. And again,
really?
It's the hacker toys. So it might just be the...
What did it give you an error?
It would... I think it just goes back to the login prompt. So it doesn't reboot. It just ended the session or something like that, if I remember right.
I forget what that is. I've seen that before. I don't know what that is because it's been a long time.
Well, I don't know if I've ever seen that.
This is on all old, you know, the proprietary Linux where, like, you know, somebody backdoored somehow and then you can, you know, add your own scripts and whatnot. So it was never on, like, an actual real install. But I've run into that a couple of times where it just logs you out and you go back to the login prompt. And
I'm guessing you would almost have to man the shutdown command then and actually see what type of variable they were using for the halt, because there I'm sure there had to have been something.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, and that's a good example of, like I said, where sometimes I actually had to do the manual halt command, and that was the
right
thing that would work.
Yep. Cool.
Computers, they are a fun thing.
They are. So I think that just about does it this week. We're about our 30. Well, probably over our 30-minute mark. But
yeah, 45.
Yeah, we're allowed. It's our podcast.
Mm-hmm. We're still doing better than the hour and a half, 2 hour ones we used to do. So
I'm gonna thank that time for next week.
Yeah, sure. Rollover minutes. Is that what you're talking about?
There you go.
The next episode. There you go. All right. So in conclusion, why don't you go ahead and follow us and join the almost 5,000 people we have following us on Twitter as @LinuxInstall. You can join our Google Plus community. over at plus.google.com/the+linux install, all one word. And of course, you can email us at podcast@linuxinstall.net. You can find out what Joe's doing over at whatimplayingnow.com. Walt's keeping his stuff over at geovec.com. Don't worry, links will be provided on the show notes for these. And I'm doing DevOps Mastery, although I haven't posted one in a couple of weeks, but I am doing DevOps Mastery over at devopsmastery.com. Is there anything I forgot?
I think that's it. But you know what everybody should go do, Brian?
They should go install some Linux.
You never get to say it, so I let you say it once.
Thanks. All right, everybody. Have a nice week.
Have a good one, everybody.
Later.
This has been a production of LinuxInstall.net. All original content produced in this podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. Please feel free to redistribute it to your friends.